This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the merits and drawbacks of U.S. President Donald Trump's executive order on a travel ban aimed at 7 Muslim-majority countries and the proposed border wall between the United States and Mexico. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. The White House executive order titled Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States has sparked fierce criticism at home and abroad. Some security analysts assert that the move will weaken rather than strengthen counterterrorism defenses erected over the past 16 years. The order bars entry to refugees from anywhere in the world for 120 days and from Syria indefinitely. It blocks any visitors for 90 days from 7 designated countries: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. A dissent cable, an official mechanism created to voice dissent to foreign policy within the U.S. State Department, has garnered more than 1,000 signatures. Nonetheless, the 90-day entry ban on citizens of these 7 countries is supported by roughly one-half of all Americans, according to polls, and is consistent with repeated promises made by Mr. Trump during his election campaign. Homeland Security Chief John Kelly said the ban is not aimed specifically at Muslims, adding that his agency's mission is to safeguard the American people, our homeland, our values. Republican Senator John McCain fears the order may actually do more to help terrorist recruitment than improve U.S. security. He added that the plan was carried out without proper consultation with U.S. allies and that it mistakenly lumped together the country's adversaries, like Iran, with allies like Iraq. And then the border wall with Mexico. President Trump triggered a major diplomatic rift between the United States and Mexico by calling for a wall along the border and insisting that Mexico would pay for it, possibly through a U.S. tax on imports. This prompted Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto to cancel his trip to Washington. The cancellation of the meeting puts on hold the U.S. leader's stated plan to renegotiate the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Building the 3,200-kilometer wall along the Mexican border was one of Trump's key proposals during the presidential election campaign. Well, with us to discuss the direction of immigration and counterterrorism policy through the lens of these executive orders are Mark Krikorian. He's executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. CIS is an independent, nonpartisan research organization in Washington, which examines and critiques the impact of immigration on the United States. And Ali Norani, he's executive director of the National Immigration Forum, and that's an advocacy organization promoting the value of immigrants and immigration in the United States. Mr. Krikorian joins us by phone from his office. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
And Ali Norani joins us here in our studio in Washington. Welcome to you.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Mark Krikorian over there at your office by phone, I'd like to discuss the executive order on protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States that has sparked so much criticism. What is your view? Are you in favor of this and why?
I mean, I'm basically in favor of it, and the important thing to understand is that it's not actually a policy, it's just the start of a policy. In other words, what the executive order that President Trump signed does is hit the pause button and puts things on hold for several months while the Homeland Security Department and State Department intelligence agencies can see whether there are changes that need to be made in admitting people, and frankly, whether it's even possible in some of these cases to actually screen people, screen out terrorists or potential terrorists from countries like, for instance, Somalia, where there is no government and no meaningful screening is even possible. But that conclusion hasn't been reached yet. This is really an interim measure to enable the government to decide whether changes are needed. And it's a prudent and limited step. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's just the first step to developing a broader policy.
Ali Norani here in the studio. How about that? Just a prudent and limited first step, a pause button How do you see the executive order on the travel ban?
Well, I'm not sure that I have seen anything from candidate Trump or President Trump that has been limited or a quiet step. This is an individual who takes bold measures and makes bold statements. And this executive order is exactly that. I think it sends a message to our allies around the world that there's a severe lack of trust in our allies' ability to share information, to make sure that folks are able to flee terrible situations. I mean, the reality is that our refugee vetting process up to this point requires, nearly 2 years of security clearances before an individual sets foot on American soil. So there is no person now who flees Somalia and ends up in the United States in a day as a refugee. What happens is that they spend a year going through United Nations security checks, and they spend a year going through United States security checks. And then, and only then, are they allowed to set foot here in the States.
Back to you, Mark Krikorian. What about those arguments made also by a bipartisan group of members of Congress, that perhaps this executive order, while perhaps well-intended, is actually counterproductive? It sends a message to our allies, even Iraq, translators and others who have worked with our armed services, suddenly being denied entry, that the U.S. vetting process for refugees is actually extremely rigorous. How about those arguments?
The rigors are exaggerated, and there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the idea that they spend 2 years being vetted is mistaken. They spend about 20 minutes being vetted. They spend 2 years waiting in line, in effect. So it's not as though they're actually being investigated for all of that time, number one. Number two, just a few days ago, the authorities in the United States discovered that for a good year, maybe, or more, several important databases were not being checked. And so they're now reexamining a number of people who were let in as refugees from Syria because important information about them was not included in the background checking. So, there's always going to be glitches like that. And the third point is that, is it really even a meaningful statement to say that we are vetting someone from Libya or Yemen or Somalia when those countries don't really exist? What does vetting mean? Do we run someone's fingerprints through the Mogadishu motor vehicles office? No, these things simply do not exist. So it's a genuine question that even the FBI and others have raised, that whether any vetting is actually possible from places where there's no information to do the vetting. In other words, the problem is not that our authorities are somehow inadequately doing the screening. It's that the material, the information necessary for successful screening simply doesn't exist.
Let me get you to respond, Ali Noorani.
Well, the United States has intelligence assets based around the world, and I think that where the president is taking this is for the American public to have a decreasing amount of trust in our intelligence services and the information that they're gathering and providing, whether it's to screen somebody as a refugee to enter the country or to screen a situation to take action from a military or economic perspective. And ultimately, what this means is that our armed services, whether they're in Iraq or Afghanistan, the trust that they have with local communities is going to be diminished because a local leader is going to say, okay, why should I help you? Because at the end of the day, the only thing that's happening is that I am being put at risk.
Turning back to you, Mark Krikorian, there's also been some dispute and concern about the actual choice of countries. For example, most of the terrorist attacks since 2001, 82% of them actually were perpetrated by legal permanent residents and not from these seven countries. And then, of course, there's the fact that Saudi Arabia and Egypt and even Pakistan were left off this list. And we note that many more terrorists come from these backgrounds. How do you respond to that discrepancy?
There's a couple of points. First of all, if anything, that objection suggests that more countries should be added to the list of places where travel is temporarily halted. Remember, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, even Pakistan, are working with us in identifying and fighting terrorists. So that's an argument that might be directed about including Iraq on the list. But even Iraq is not really a country any longer. It's three separate countries. And we have had repeated problems with people both in Iraq and Afghanistan who we thought were our allies and end up not being our allies and attacking our own soldiers and killing our own people. So it seems to me this is a prudent and limited step. And the idea that somehow this is going to radicalize people simply because the United States is taking temporary steps to improve its own security is kind of ridiculous, really. And my final point would be here that Kuwait has banned travel from a number of these countries and a number of others specifically for security reasons. This is not some kind of radical departure or really all that unusual a step.
Turning to you, Ali Noorani here in the studio, about the choice of countries, the fact that several from which many terrorists have emanated were left off, that it seems a random, to some extent, notwithstanding the Trump administration's assertion that a lot of these countries were designated by the previous administration, Obama administration. But how about that?
Well, I think it really is a radical departure, not just from the way that we as a nation have shaped and implemented our refugee programs, but I think it's a radical departure in the way that we have operated in the global theater in terms of really a security powerhouse. I think that one of the most alarming elements of this is that the Trump administration did not consult the experts. You know, DHS and the intelligence agencies do their job. This was a small group of individuals within the Oval Office who said, hey, let's do this. Let's make our dreams come true and, you know, send a message to the Muslim world that we do not trust you and we will not work with you. And I just think that in the short term and the long term, that just sends a very, very bad message to the world and, again, puts our troops in harm's way. And I think at the end of the day also undermines our own national security.
Mark Krikorian, let me get you to respond to that, because others have also made the same argument that the Trump administration, Mr. Trump, did not consult experts within the government first, but that this was hastily written. The process itself undermines perhaps the goal, and the goal itself is in question as well, whether on humanitarian grounds, security grounds, counterterrorism grounds.
Well, there's a couple of points to make here. Number one, 90% of the world's Muslims are not covered by this so-called Muslim ban. So it's neither Muslim nor a ban because it's only a temporary pause. And the second point I think it's important to make so we understand what we're talking about is there are two separate measures here. One suspends all refugee resettlement from everywhere, even from Congo and Burma, wherever the source, for 120 days to have a bottom-up reexamination of our refugee program. And the other part is the 90-day pause in travel from these seven countries which are designated and have been designated under the previous administration by the State Department as countries of concern. Five of those seven countries, the state really does not exist in any meaningful sense. And then in two of them, Sudan and Iran, they're sworn enemies of the United States who are state sponsors of terrorism. So it's actually a very narrow group of countries that we took this step of a full travel ban. The other countries, like Pakistan, like Saudi Arabia, UAE, whatever, that do in fact harbor terrorists, are also subject to relatively stringent checks. It's just that apparently the administration decided not to include them in the narrow group of countries where travel is halted altogether for a short period of time.
Well, to your point about the fact that it's not a Muslim ban per se, and that's exactly right. On the other hand, it's being perceived by many around the world and here in America that it's sort of a de facto ban. In other words, the perception is in all politics is almost everything, and this feeds the perception, critics say, that the United States is at war with Islam.
You know, I'm sorry, but the fact is that the threats we face, threats particularly to our homeland, are in fact mainly coming from Islamic extremists. Not all Muslims are extremists, but all Islamic extremists are Muslim. And so inevitably, in trying to battle and combat Muslim extremism, the people we're targeting are by definition going to be Muslim. But a policy that focuses only on specific problematic, dangerous countries that, of course, do happen to be Muslim is not an indictment of Islam in general. And quite frankly, it's the media and other voices that are creating this impression, not the action by the government itself.
I would say that the implementation of this is an indication that, at least at this point in time, the Trump administration is stretched incredibly thin and, I fear, underwater. For chaos to break out at airports across the country where Border Patrol customs officers do not know how to implement such a high-profile executive order. Again, you know, I think we can parse out what the intentions were, how it's perceived, but the reality is that this policy was very poorly developed and executed in a ham-handed way at best.
That's a legitimate point, that the initial execution was clumsy. There's no question. There were about 2 days of kind of screw-ups at a lot of airports, and that's a legitimate complaint. But, you know, remember, the healthcare.gov website took weeks and weeks to get functional. Government isn't always as efficient and as competent as we would like it, and there are going to be speed bumps like this. The fact is that the initial problems, which were real, are now over. They only lasted for a couple of days, and now the officials at the airport and the State Department people abroad have a clear idea of what their marching orders are from the president. So those initial problems were real, but they're now over.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Mark Krikorian. He's executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, and Ali Noorani. He's executive director of the National Immigration Forum. We're discussing the merits and liabilities of several U.S. executive orders, a controversial ban on refugees in seven Muslim-majority nations, and soon, the wall on the border of the United States and Mexico. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to our valued Nairobi listeners on FM 107.5. How do you feel about the cutback in airtimes for Encounter? Are you able to catch us on Sundays at 8 a.m. local time? Please send us feedback on this program change, good or bad, to Encounter at voanews.com or leave a message on our Facebook page at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, back to our guests. And now, Mark Krikorian, let's talk about the controversial executive order to build a wall along the border between Mexico and the United States, another promise during the campaign by President Trump. Are you in favor of this, especially given the flap and the fallout between the United States and Mexico, the cancellation of the visit, and the fact that the Mexican president says that Mexico will not pay for that wall?
Candidate Trump, when he was running, made clear that, number one, this is something he was for, but number two, it wouldn't necessarily require being built along the entire length of the U.S. border with Mexico, which is 2,000 miles long. He had said kind of off the cuff, you know, we might need 1,000 miles of border because in some areas the terrain doesn't warrant it. So first thing to understand is this is not a commitment to build 2,000 miles of concrete or stone masonry walls. The next point is that we already have hundreds of miles of fencing with Mexico. Roughly speaking, we have about 700 miles of fencing, so it's about one-third of the border. Of that fencing, one-half of it is sort of low fencing designed to keep automobiles and trucks from driving across the border, but it doesn't stop people. And then about half, so roughly 450, something like that, kilometers of the border with Mexico already has very high fencing, which some people already call a wall. So this isn't a new thing. This is just something that the president is proposing to expand and make both longer and presumably maybe two layers instead of one layer. My point here is that this is merely a plan to expand something that already exists. And that's separate from the issue of antagonizing Mexico, which I think is a mistake, quite frankly. The intentional baiting of Mexico is something we shouldn't be doing. Mexico, along with Canada, they're the two most important countries to the United States in the world. And so this idea of constantly poking at the Mexicans and saying they're going to pay for the wall, which obviously directly they're not going to be paying for the wall, strikes me as gratuitous and unnecessary.
Well, Ali Noorani, it sounds like you two might have a point of convergence on this particular issue. How do you see it?
Well, I'm sitting here slightly stunned. And so I think that there are smart border enforcement measures that need to be put into place. First of all, when you look at the data, the majority of drugs, guns, and money being smuggled between the U.S. and Mexico actually flow through the land ports of entry. So there should be an investment in those ports of entry in order to improve their security, but also to make sure that trade and tourism can flow through those ports in a timely and secure fashion. Second, there are very low-cost but incredibly effective measures that can be taken along the Rio Grande River, where there's this invasive species called Carrizo cocaine that blocks the sight lines of Border Patrol. You remove that invasive species, which actually the environmentalists are very happy about this idea as well, and all of a sudden people have no place to hide. Again, the problem here is the rhetoric from the White House and the rhetoric specifically from the president, where I take what he says is that, you know, he wants to dramatically expand the physical infrastructure along the border. Yes, there will be places that it's physically impossible to build a wall, but I think he wants to, frankly, have that $10 billion press conference where he says, this is where I'm building the wall, I'm driving the first stake, and the border is therefore secure. Which, from a policy perspective, it's wrong. There are better policy measures to take along the border that will improve our security.
Mark Krikorian, is this an example, perhaps, of a campaign promise that we heard on the campaign trail over and over again? I'm going to build that wall and the Mexicans are going to pay for it. Is this an example of not a good translation into actual policy? Because both of you have mentioned that this is not a good idea in terms of having sparked a rift between the United States and an important neighbor. And there are also other facts that say that a wall wouldn't necessarily stop smugglers from tunneling underground, for example, nor do a majority of unlawful immigrants actually come through the border, that they actually enter on U.S. visas, that they overstay. Anyway, what about the facts versus the rhetoric, and how does this affect our important relationship with an important neighbor?
The actual policy of improving policing at the border and in giving the Border Patrol additional tools is valuable and important and is not what sparks the problematic relationship with Mexico. Those are two separate things. We need to do better at the border, although you are right that something like half of new illegal immigration comes from visa overstayers, people who enter legally, who have lied to the face of our consular officers about their intent to go back and then simply don't go back. So that's a serious problem, but the border is also a serious problem. In other words, we have to address all of the ways that people illegally enter or illegally stay in the United States. Mexico is not going to be in a huff because we are attempting to control our own border. What angers them, and I would say even more than that, I think it's more like it humiliates them, the way we're talking about Mexico. And that, I agree, needs to be dialed down, but that's distinct from the policy itself. And let me just make one more point here. The part of the appeal to the public of this idea of a wall with Mexico is that it is a public and open assertion of our sovereignty. After years, several administrations of both parties that frankly have downplayed or even denigrated the idea of American sovereignty. And so it's necessary simply as a symbolic measure, and I don't mean symbolically toward Mexico, but for the public itself as an indication that its own government is in solidarity with the concerns that the public has, because that's really a core of our political instability, certainly over the past couple of years, is that much of the public simply doesn't think that the government is on their side. And you're seeing the same thing in Europe with Brexit and all the rest of it.
I would actually agree with Mark on this. I think that the symbolic power of a wall is just incredibly poignant at this moment. Again, I don't want to dismiss that, and I'm certainly not going to dismiss the feeling of so many Americans who feel like the government does not work for them. On the other hand, I think there is a responsibility of both Republicans and Democrats to develop and execute good policy. And you know, when you look at the amount of resources that have been invested along the southwest border, we realize that hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent for federal immigration enforcement agencies. Deportations have gone up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Republicans and Democrats have never come together in a coherent and constructive way to actually move legislation to fix this problem that serves the interests of the American worker and American families. Instead, we have now a symbolic wall that is being built by some inflammatory rhetoric that, you know, in the worst case scenario, is going to put 5 million American jobs that depend on trade with Mexico at risk. And that is a slippery slope to be on right now.
So we shall see how this will play out in the weeks and months ahead. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Mark Krikorian, he's Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies, and Ali Norani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. Mark, thank you so much for joining us by phone.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
And thanks to you as well, Ali Norani, here in the studio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rashad Smith. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.